This podcast is, of course, made possible through the support of our members and from Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community with convenient locations throughout northern New England. World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. As Labor Day approaches, for many Granite Staters, it's the last chance to throw the camping gear in the car and head to the woods for one final outdoor overnight adventure. But since when did sleeping on the bumpy ground with critters and bugs become a leisure activity? Well, our guest today has some answers. In his new book, Under the Stars, author Dan White explores the evolution of camping in the United States, from Henry David Thoreau on Walden Pond to Theodore Roosevelt and John Muir in Yellowstone. Along the way, White managed to make a few unorthodox camping trips of his own, including an intense night in the Santa Cruz Mountains of California, carrying nothing and wearing nothing but a loincloth. So roast that marshmallow and roll out your sleeping bags, because today in The Exchange, it's the history of camping with author Dan White. Let's hear from you. If you camp, why do you do it? Give us your best camping story. And if you wouldn't dream of camping, why not? Give us a call. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Dan White joins us from California. And Dan, welcome. It's great to have you.
Great to be here.
Well, here's the existential question that you address in the book, Dan. Let's start with it. Why go camping? Why not just stay comfortable in your nice soft bed and not get dirty?
It's a great question. I like to camp to shake up my routine. If the pressure gets too much, if I just feel kind of reined in from my suburban lifestyle, I like to go out there and have this ritual out of doors where my context changes, where everything simplifies, at least in theory, and also just knowing that I'm going to experience a little bit of chaos, like homeopathic chaos, where things are going to become unpredictable, where I'm going to break away from the usual way of doing things. For me, it's just a reset button, just the whole idea of doing the tasks and exposure to a vague degree of risk and to the elements and to animals and creatures and other people. For me, it just is a sort of a start over button, and it helps me go back and kind of fulfill my function in the rest of my life.
Wait, what did you call that? Homeopathic confusion?
Yeah.
What does that mean?
It's one of those early in the morning terms.
Yeah.
A homeopathic dose of chaos. And I think what happens for me is, maybe it's just this, it's my personal energy, but every time I go camping, it's so incredibly unpredictable. I think it is for most people where your best laid plans kind of go adrift, where you'll go out there and you'll think in your head as you're driving up to the campsite, this is how I want things to go. This is what I want to see. And then, you know, the cloud formations will roll in, the weather system you didn't expect, or I'll get attacked by marmots, or something will happen where it's just completely different from my expectation. So I think that one thing that's really good for camping is it requires me to have a sense of humor, because things tend to sort of go off the rails.
Well, and you call camping a combination of enchantment and abuse. So why get abused?
Why get abused? You know, because I show up for the enchantment. The abuse part of it, the chaos part of it, the stuff going off the rails, that's something that's just kind of the price tag.
You're so honest about this, Dan.
Well, I try to be honest, because what I don't want to do is tell people, go out there and everything will be perfect, because I've heard so many camping stories in which everything goes south. But the thing about camping that I think is so interesting and so funny is that a person can redeem a camping experience through the telling. Like, there's a phrase, bad for life, good for story. So even if you have a rather, you know, a nightmarish camping experience, unless something truly tragic or horrible happens, unless it's just some vague chaos things that happen to you, you can usually redeem this through the telling, through an entertaining story. So you can usually redeem a camping story in retrospect and through telling other people about it. It's really fun to talk about camping trips gone awry for some reason.
If you count all the types of camping, Dan, from hardcore backpacking in the wilderness to RVs with, you know, all the lights ablazing, how many Americans go camping every year, just roughly?
It's supposed to be upwards of 45 million, even closer to 50 million from what I've heard, from statistics that I've read, which is a pretty whopping huge amount. And of course, it's important to realize, as you said, that there are so many varieties of camping. One person will go out there and do the hardcore backpacking by him or herself, and then you got the glamping, the upscale stuff. So it takes all kinds.
Well, we'll definitely talk a little bit later, get your views on what's real camping and what isn't. But setting that aside for just a second, how much is camping, Dan, largely a North American pastime, meaning the U.S. and the Canadians? I mean, do they camp in Russia? Do they camp in Bolivia? Do they camp in Japan?
There is an international camping tradition. It's everywhere. I've heard, and I haven't studied on this very much, but I've heard that in Japan there's a huge RVing tradition, that it's huge there. And a lot of our camping tradition is influenced by English people. By English people who either helped found some camping tradition here or things that we've kind of copied or borrowed from them. And over in England, they call it caravanning when you're sleeping in an RV. So yes, there is, to varying degrees, there is a camping tradition in other countries. And certainly the romantic European tradition influenced camping to begin with here. So yes, we owe a certain debt to other countries when it comes to that. But I think there's something uniquely American in just how obsessed we are with camping and just the wild varieties of camping here. I think in some sense that's uniquely American, the way that we've developed a certain kind of camping that suits just about anybody.
A little more on that, please. Obsessed.
Obsessed. I really feel like there's something about camping that is part of the American identity. And I kind of think that it's the unique way that we've related to wild places for so many years. I think that we'll talk more about him later, but President Theodore Roosevelt really kind of equated wild places with nationalism, this whole idea of our American identity being tied up in these beautiful places that we've set aside for American vacations. There's something unique about that, about having a national identity that is rooted in these campouts, that's rooted in these wilderness areas, that's part of our national heritage, part of our pride, part of what we think of ourselves as Americans. So we're really re-engaging with that when we go out and we camp.
Well, an appropriate sentiment there, Dan, on the 100th anniversary of the national parks, right? Just this week.
Absolutely.
The phone number for you to join us as we talk about camping is 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Author Dan White is with us. His new book is called Under the Stars, How America Fell in Love with Camping. And let's hear from you, your best camping story, your worst camping story, or if you wouldn't dream of camping, give us a call. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Again, you can always find us on Facebook or Twitter. So, Dan, when did Americans first start latching on to this idea that camping could actually be fun?
People were messing around with this much earlier than I expected. Even colonial times, you had people experimenting with fun camping. And, you know, the strange, eccentric thing about that is, of course, there's always been camping in American history, always. This incredible Native American camping tradition going back for millennia, and the pioneers camped, but people did this to survive. They thought of wilderness usually as some sort of obstacle, something to confront. You did have people messing around with this even in the 1700s. You had there was a fellow named William Byrd who was out mapping this disputed boundary line, and it's one of the earliest examples I've found. It was in the 1720s, where he was talking about camping for fun, even though he could have camped indoors if he wanted to, which was really eccentric and kind of jarring back then. And in 1818, this fellow named Estwick Evans, took place in New Hampshire. He left in New Hampshire in 18, I think it was 18 in the dead of winter, and in buffalo robes and moccasins, and went out there to explore America for reasons other than survival. And he was considered kind of a lunatic at the time, but it didn't really start. People thought, well, who is this guy? Is he some sort of spy leaving New Hampshire in dressed like this with his hunting dogs in the middle of winter? Are you crazy? But he did this, I wouldn't say exactly for fun. It was more of a spiritual thing, but he did this for reasons other than survival, and he hiked for hundreds of miles, camped out every night with his little tent. It didn't really start catching on and becoming more of a thing until, I'd say, after the Civil War. That's when it really started to catch on, and part of it was because America was a mess. We had just gone through this traumatic experience, this traumatic war. The country had been really divided, and there was this plague of perceived neurosis that had overtaken America, starting the Eastern Seaboard, this condition called neurasthenia, where people were convinced they were losing their minds. So I think there was that perceived this feeling of unhappiness, this sort of massive feeling of neurosis that propelled us into the woods en masse for the first time. And people really started discovering camping out recreationally around the same time when this was diagnosed. It was 1869, really, that was kind of the hinge.
Wow.
People started really packing up their stuff, and newspapers were really hyping it. And you started having these camping guidebooks, and people started really taking to camping. It started really spreading right around that time.
So after the Civil War, America is feeling kind of bereft, depressed, whatever you want to call it. Lots of industrialization going on, of course, at that time. So people said, let's go to the woods and sort of heal ourselves?
That's exactly right. And, you know, what's interesting is before the Civil War, there's an historian named Phil Terry who helped me out with some interesting information about the Adirondacks, where there's a lot of early camping. And he told me that camping before the Civil War was largely a matter of the soul. In other words, it had this sort of a religious aspect of it, people going out into the woods and seeking company with God. And it was just very, very spiritual. And, of course, that didn't end after the Civil War, but it became more secular, it became more spread out. Women became a bit more welcome into the woods. It was very sexist, very kind of constrained at first in the first half of the 19th century, and it became more spread out and, you know, bring the kids and more of a family thing, more like camping as we know it after the Civil War. Before then, it was mostly kind of romantic wayfarers going out there, having these ecstatic experiences, and it became kind of more of a homely thing, something more that we'd recognize. We'd see these people camping now, and we wouldn't think they were complete weirdos. They'd be somewhat more relatable after the Civil War.
Instead of the guy from New Hampshire who set out in February with his buffalo skins and his moccasins.
Yes, someone who was almost in kind of a trance, someone who would seem, even now, would seem a little bit kooky to us.
You know, going back a little bit earlier to the colonial era where you said camping was not, you know, a thing that people did. And you also noted, Dan, that Native Americans, camping was how they lived. I mean, it wasn't sort of camping versus regular life. That was how they lived in harmony with the outdoors. How did that influence how whites saw camping early on? They wanted to distinguish themselves from how the natives lived.
Well, a lot of it was just adapting survival skills directly from Native Americans. That's what happened at first, with just to survive. The colonialists had to figure out how to adapt to the landscape, how to live with the landscape, and how to grow things and how to stalk prey. And a lot of that was appropriate. I mean, people to varying degrees had these survival skills already from when they came over from Europe. Some people were fairly clueless, but they had to learn really quickly. And then over the years, there were was a lot of adaptation. The mountain men in the western frontier in the early 1800s, they had a lot of their own skills, but they adapted or stole or borrowed a lot of skills from Native Americans. And in turn, the mountain men kind of influenced some early recreational camping. And so all these things kind of leached into the American tradition. Also, there was just a lot of borrowing not only the skills, but also the iconography, the imagery with the early Boy Scouts, the whole idea of adapting Native American, you know, names for things and using teepees. And sometimes you'd have these early recreational encampments that was really kind of a mishmash of Native American traditions, everything kind of all glommed together, where you'd have just different aspects of Native American culture and tradition kind of blended together or really simplified for recreational purposes.
Well, and you've put a couple names out there already, but who were some of those early opinion shapers in that era when camping really took off as an American pastime? Who kind of pushed public opinion toward the idea that camping could be the wholesome, fun family activity?
You know, the big name that jumps out at me really is this fellow named William H. H. Murray, who was nicknamed Adirondack Murray because he's so closely associated with the Adirondacks in upstate New York. And he was a Boston-based pastor for a pretty upscale church. And he really raised a lot of eyebrows because he would rush in to his sermons after hunting and camping in the woods. He'd be all sweaty, wearing his pantaloons and pompous hunting rifle against the wall and start preaching. And he was fairly controversial for the way he was really just caught up in camping early on. But what he did, he made a name for himself by having this enormously popular book called Adventures in the Wilderness about camping out. It was published on or around April Fool's Day, kind of tellingly, as it turned out, in 1869. And it was one of the first books that really made it seem like camping could be easy and fun and bring the family, and you'll have great fishing, you'll have a great time out there, don't worry about the hardships. And what happened was he caused this just massive surge of interest in camping, and people would pack up rather unprepared.
I've never done that before.
yeah, I know. It's another early example of Americans rushing out way in over their head. And he rushed out there, and these people emulating him rushed out there, and, you know, unfortunately, they had a pretty rotten time. As can happen, the weather wasn't good. They were bitten by black flies. They got lost. They had these wilderness guides back there that people would hire to take them into the woods, but they got all the guides were booked up, and people got these sort of local drunks taking them to the woods, and it was this disaster. And it was pretty sad for Mr. Murray, because he was really embarrassed, and people called the campers who emulated him, they called them Murray's fools, and people really ridiculed him in editorial cartoons, and his reputation never really recovered. And what's funny was he was advocating things that would seem so common to us now, but they were fairly radical then. But I really think he's one of the people to really stick his neck out and really make a public splash to really stick up for this kind of camping. And he kind of paid a price. I mean, they really kind of dragged him the mud for doing this. But I really think of him as part of the hinge, as sort of this kind of a before and after, in the sense of this person coming along and really advocating so forcefully for this. And he's kind of forgotten now, unless you're really kind of obsessively interested in camping history. He's a name that's not familiar anymore, but he was really one of the big ones.
Our phone number again on the exchange for you to join us with your camping stories, disaster or fabulous adventure, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Dan, first up is Steve in Nottingham. Hi, Steve. Go ahead. You're in the exchange. Welcome.
Good morning.
Morning.
First of all, a shout-out to scouting. That's where I first had my experience camping as a Boy Scout, and I think that's a great way to introduce people. And I want to, of course, talk about Lord Baden-Powell, because he founded the Boys Guides of the World. But getting back to scouting, when I became a scoutmaster when I went to College Tufts, I had a scout troop, and I took my scout troop camping, and we were another one of my scouts, and I was in my pup tent, and I had a dream that the Nazis were trapping me. And I then, in the middle, because in response to this dream, in the dream, I unbuttoned the whole tent. And so we woke up with the sleeping bags in the middle of the wilderness with no tent over us.
Oh, my goodness. Well, and, you know, sometimes when you sleep out, you do have weird dreams because you're not sleeping the way you do at home. Go ahead, Dan, if you want to comment on the influence of the Scouts, Boys and Girl Scouts in camping. You talk about that in the book.
Yes. You know, first of all, I envy your experience. I was in the Scouts just for a few hours, and I just I don't think I was quite ready for it, and I quit, and I really wish that I stuck with it, because it's just, I've heard so many people having great experiences. But really, the Scouts are so influential, because I think of the Scouts as a really big early influence of the whole self-reliance in the wilderness thing. I mean, before the Scouts came along, you had this tradition of always hiring a guide to help you out. For some reason, the early recreational campers were very often kind of scared to go into the woods by themselves. So they'd hire a guide who is the equivalent of the Super Eagle Scout before it existed. These local guides who lived in these local areas, and they were great lumbermen and great survivalists, and they would hire these people to do everything, and they would kind of micromanage the camp out. And then later on, you had people like Theodore Roosevelt say, let's go out there and survive on our own, and the whole strenuous life thing and self-discipline. So I'd say the Boy Scouts, and something just a few years later, the Girl Scouts, were really important in the idea that going out there and learning these survival skills could be not only character building and soul building, but also really fun.
Something that you could do. I'm going to cut you off there for just a second, Dan. And coming up, why camping is, as Dan White puts it, so white. Stay with us. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're talking with author Dan White. His new book is Under the Stars, How America Fell in Love with Camping. It's about the history of camping, some of the early opinion shapers, also Dan White's own experiences with different types of camping and how camping has just become a staple of summer leisure in America. Let's hear from you. Your camping stories are welcome and your questions and comments. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Dan, your book addresses head on a question that a lot of people in the outdoors world are asking these days. Why is camping, as you put it, so blazingly white?
Yes, you know, and that's one of those things that I set out to investigate in the book. And just a lot of it has to do with just the different way that different groups of people are oriented to the woods. When I went out there, and I camped with in the Everglades with a group of kids, teenage girls, as it turns out. I didn't know what the demographic exactly was going to be when I went out there, but all teenage girls who are either African American or Hispanic, and I went with chaperones. It was part of a branch of the Sierra Club that goes out there and takes kids out into the woods. And what a lot of the parents told, the kids told me, is that some of the parents felt like camping was a white thing, that African Americans don't do this. And, you know, it's funny because with the kids that I went camping with, it seemed to me that that value hadn't yet had a chance to sort of set and harden in their minds. And a lot of them really just liked the experience and really enjoyed it. But also what I heard from African-American historians is just this different way of engaging with the land. Of course, one huge issue would be slavery, just a much different relationship with the land at the same time where Americans were developing this pre-environmentalist or transcendental tradition. You had millions of African Americans who were bound to the land in a very different kind of way. And it's not quite so simple, because there was also the sense of the land being a release where people would escape from the plantations, and they'd use the wilderness as kind of a way of escaping. I talked to a writer named Brandon Harris, who talked to me about these escaped slaves who would go into the Great Dismal Swamp, and they'd used the wilderness against the people who were trying to recapture them, because a lot of the slavers were too terrified to go into the woods and retrieve them. So it's this incredibly complex view of the wilderness. It's just that different ethnic groups in certain situations can have a different way of visualizing the relationship with the land. And I think that's part of it. But the other part of it, the students also told me that they sometimes just don't feel welcome in national parks and camping areas. Part of it is because they feel like they are not seeing people who look like themselves. They're not necessarily seeing enough mentors who look like them. They're not necessarily seeing enough fellow campers who look like them, if that makes sense. So sometimes there's this feeling of just feeling out of place, of feeling not entirely welcome.
Sure.
And, you know, having said that, when I was out there with these kids, I would say 90% of them just had a great time and were really rolling with it. And the thing that really got me, too, is that every girl in that trip was really different. I mean, there were a couple kids who seemed pretty freaked out about being there, and there are other kids who were way more comfortable in the wilderness than I was, because of different experiences in childhood, different backgrounds. There's just there's a very wide range of reactions and experiences out there. But it is a problem. I mean, it's still the demographics are so lopsided even now, even with the progress we've made, that you sometimes have to ask yourself, who is this for? Like, who is camping for if it's really restricted mostly to just one demographic?
So what are the demographics? I mean, just roughly.
Well, I'd say it's about 80% white and African American. I mean, I've heard very different statistics about this, but, you know, ranging between 4% and 5% African American, and then smatterings of other groups. But, you know, the good news is that you have these outreach groups out there that are making inroads, and it's not just groups like the Sierra Club that are doing outreach. It's also groups of African Americans, of Hispanic wilderness seekers that are going out there and having these kind of meetup groups, and they are making a dent. And it does seem to me that in the last few years, I have gone out into certain camping areas and seen more diversity. I was just out in Mount Rainier National Park with my wife and my daughter, and it was extremely diverse. I mean, granted, we weren't way out there in the backcountry, but off doing day hikes and into some of these wild areas, it did seem a lot less blindingly white than what I'm accustomed to. I mean, I hiked the Pacific Crest Trail in 1993 and 1994, and I saw no unwhite faces anywhere in the entire experience. And it was 2,600 miles in the backcountry,
wow,
which was kind of jarring for me. It seems like things are changing, and my wild guess is that we're trending towards more diversity, but it's still pretty lopsided.
So the parents and the grandparents of the girls that you went camping with, the Latino and African-American girls, more than one of them said, you know, blacks don't camp. I'm quoting directly from the book, maybe partly because of this connection where when you are tied to the land as a slave, you know, the last thing you want to do is be out on the land. It's a mark of status to not be out getting dirty.
But and one of the girls, see, this is really important for me because I wanted to hear what they had to say and to sort of be a mouthpiece for what they wanted to say. But one of the girls told me that it was also this feeling of being oriented towards urban life. And also just this particular girl was really obsessed with, I keep using the word obsessed, but preoccupied with her hair. She was really worried about being dirty, and she was really worried about sleeping in the dirt in the tent. She said, gosh, the whole wilderness experience to me feels really dirty. So that particular girl felt like it was unnerving out there just to be exposed to the elements and to be exposed to dirt. But, you know, then again, there were other kids who were just really reveling in the dirt and the mud and all that. So, you know, I think a lot of it depends on parents. On what
well,
the parents were saying.
One last question about this trip, and it's a fascinating chapter in the book. One girl said being without her cell phone was, quote, the worst experience of my life. I'm wondering if this is how, Dan, a lot of young people of all races feel. You know, yes, I'd like to go camping, but only if there's Wi-Fi and a cell connection.
You got it. I mean, see, when that was a teenager, and I had a really kind of a funny rapport with her. And when she said that, gosh, that was one of the worst experiences of my life. I didn't have my cell phone. I thought, that's your typical teenager. I mean, that crosses ethnic, cultural lines. That's just across the board. You know, and I think that it's really true that some kids, and, you know, having grown up just before the telecommunications boom, I was really taken aback at first. I've seen some really young people who are just on their phones texting and checking just constantly all the time and feeling like it's sort of their job. There's this feeling in which I've talked to some young teens who just seem deeply unnerved when they're disconnecting from this because it's almost like they're going to fall behind in some way. And I think that it's really great when you get out into a wilderness area where you just don't have that option, where you have to disconnect, where you're not constantly reaching for your phone because there's no connection. And of course, the sad thing these days is you have some people who are so tech savvy that they can create their own Wi-Fi hotspots from whatever. You know, there are people who can make a Wi-Fi hotspot out of a Pringle can. A can of Pringles potato chips. They eat the Pringles, and they can make it into sort of this crazy antenna. So wherever they are, they have like a little instant Wi-Fi hotspot, which is sad. I mean, it's more of a choice these days about whether you can disconnect because, you know, these days fewer and fewer places are unwired. But I feel like, ideally speaking, I mean, certainly it was true for that particular camp out in the Everglades where it was amazing to see how the campfire took the place of all that.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't have
something to
they
focus
didn't have
on.
Any of those apps, didn't have any of those things, but they were just talking by the fire, telling a lot of ghost stories, and how the fire really subsumed the role of all those things. That, I thought, was the most amazing thing.
So how should camping places address this, Dan, this desire by a lot of younger Americans that, you know, if I'm not connected, then I'm not interested, I'm not coming?
Certainly outreach is really, really important, and certainly having more excursions, more meetups that just normalize it. I mean, there are groups out there that are doing really great work of just showing that it's already part of cultural tradition. There's a group called Outdoor Afro that's this national group that really makes the case that outdoor heritage in a positive way has always been part of African-American tradition. It's kind of reestablishing connection. There's a group called Latino Outdoors that also talks about this rich history.
I'm talking about the cell phone connection or the wireless connection.
I'm
wondering
course,
how you think, you know, campgrounds or outdoor adventure places should address this if they want to keep bringing in new generations, but those new generations say, I'm not coming if I can't, you know, post a picture on Instagram because you have no Wi-Fi.
Okay, well, great question. You know, I think that part of it is coming to grips with the idea that not all technology is bad out there. I mean, if there are kids who I sometimes see using apps to identify bird calls or using technology in a way that heightens the natural experience, I think that can really help. And I do feel like this sort of availability needs to be there for Wi-Fi if there's an emergency situation, if people really need to be evacuated out of there. But I do feel like the kids could be gently encouraged to just try to disengage, just to try to experience nature in a different way. I mean, I feel like, I think that I've seen this myself with my own kid, that you can find ways of sort of replacing all those things with what's at hand. Especially if I think maybe the best outreach is just implicating the kids in the camping trips we do. They won't feel completely compelled to always be checking their cell phones all the time if we give them all a role, if we make the camping trip theirs. Like if I go camping with a group of young people, if I really give each person a task, so I really give them a feeling of ownership of it, so they won't feel so inclined or so tempted to tune out with these devices. I mean, that might be the best approach, I think.
Let's go back to our listeners, Stan. Lots of people who want to jump in with their camping stories. 1-800-892-6477. Our guest today on The Exchange, author Dan White, his brand new book, Under the Stars, How America Fell in Love with Camping. And as Labor Day weekend approaches, for some people, that's the last chance to pack up and go camping. So let's hear from you about your own experiences camping, or if you never dream of going camping. Of course, we'd love to hear from you, too. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. And Dean is in Rochester. Hi, Dean. Go ahead. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi. How are you?
Fine. Go ahead, Dean.
Well, back in 1981, my father took my brother and I on a trip across the United States for an entire year, a camping trip.
An entire year, Dean?
An entire year. Yeah. Yeah. We got a 20-foot tag-along trailer, and we headed out from Merrimack, New Hampshire, and we headed down to Washington, D.C., then to Florida, Texas, California, and then Yosemite, and we tried to stay in a lot of state and national parks along the way. It was an amazing thing.
What was amazing about it, Dean? Yeah.
Well, today it's more important to me today as an adult.
Uh-huh.
Then, you know, I was only 9, but reflecting on it, it was such a great thing. I love camping today. I love camping with my family. I camp by myself sometimes. And I also have a sense of civic duty. I volunteer and, that just makes that's a big benefit for the person as well as you know whatever particular cause you're volunteering for. So all this stems from that trip.
Wow, what a tribute to your dad, Dean. Thank you so much for calling in. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome. Go camp.
I plan to on Labor Day weekend for sure. And Dan White, you know, so much in there, but let's talk about the dad connection, because you write about this in the book. For a lot of Americans, men and women, there's a dad thing when it comes to camping.
There is. And so I'm speaking at a personal level as well as an historical way. I mean, I just have to say my own father. And that was a really lovely story, by the way, that I just heard. My own father, he just passed away in March. This would have been his 90th birthday just a month ago, and he was such a huge influence on my camping practice. And, you know, what's interesting about him is he grew up in poverty. He grew up in tenements on the Lower East Side of Manhattan, and he was an orphan. And his one escape was really sort of the Hudson Highlands, and sometimes there'd be a tugboat that would take this barge up into the woods out there. And he'd really, I think that seeing the woods in that part of New York really inspired him to, you know, work hard and kind of get out of there. And what's really interesting is he grew up in this really sort of depressing, this crushing poverty. And when he grew up and had kids of his own, he really made it a priority to take us wilderness camping. I mean, a lot of people have a car camping tradition. I'm certainly doing that with my kid now. But we were just going straight out into the wilderness. We were doing parts of the John Muir Trail. We were way up there in the High Sierras doing these full-on backpacking trips with bears snuffling around, and we were out there in the middle of nowhere. And it was this kind of overwhelming experience for me. And I think that was really my camping indoctrination, was just being so far out there and being kind of self-reliant and this very simple life. And we were out there for days at a time. And having said that, I was really curious about how fatherhood related to other camping, other heroes of camping in American history. And, you know, lo and behold, it turned out that a lot of the people who have such a big influence on American camping, there's some issue involving their dads. Either it's someone like Theodore Roosevelt, who said his father was the finest man who ever he'd ever met, and Theodore Roosevelt was a weakling growing up, and he was asthmatic, and he had all these health problems, and his father took him aside and said, "Son, you must make your body." And so Theodore Roosevelt really took him seriously and weightlifted and tried to make himself healthy and stout. But one of the big things that Theodore Roosevelt did because of his dad was go camping in honor of his father. And then think of all the wilderness areas that Theodore Roosevelt has saved and protected. A lot of that value came right from his dad. And, you know, the flip side of that is I noticed that a lot of the heroes of camping, including just a whole group of people, John Muir, for example, had the most horrible issues involving their dad. Either there was some issue of the dad being really a harsh disciplinarian, or the dad being absent from the picture. And it's across the board for so many of them. And I thought, to me, it seemed to me that in these cases where people had these bad relationships with their dad, and they later became these champions of camping, it's almost like maybe they were trying to create this sort of a family value that they didn't have for other people, for other campers. So there's something really, I think, poignant about the intense relationships that these people had with their fathers, either for good or for bad.
Well, and you also write in the book that after camping sort of took off post-Civil War, it wasn't too much longer that women got involved. There's a lot of women we could talk about. But what about the founder of the Girl Scouts and how she encouraged girls to get out there and get dirty?
Yes, I'm really glad you mentioned her, Juliet Gordon Lowe. Nicknamed Daisy. Actually, at one point, nicknamed Crazy Daisy.
Because she wanted girls to get outside?
No, because she was a bit eccentric when she was young. That's all. She just was very headstrong and very willful. But she was really a force. And, you know, what you said is absolutely true. I mean, at first, that there was this real barrier for women with camping. It was almost like a men's club in the early days. And I think it's because men just were feeling threatened in the industrial age, where there was the jobs were less manly than before, and men were doing fewer things with their hands, and there's this diminishing artisan tradition. So you had this sort of reactionary impulse to go out there, and we're going to make camping this all-male thing, and it's our male kind of macho domain. And so these women making these inroads to camping, they faced a lot of resistance, and she was really a pioneer because she went out there and championed this girls group that would not only foster camping skills and survival in the woods, but also this feeling of a bit of self-reliance in life, in the life outside the campground. Because Juliet Lowe was in this horrible relationship with a husband who cheated on her, and after he passed away, she found out that he wanted to give all the money to the mistress, and she just had this really just bad situation. And after she had some money that finally she fought for the money that was owed to her, and she got that money, she really just delved into the scouting history and decided to found this movement of her own. And, you know, the amazing thing is this, a woman who had been abandoned by her husband, and in Victorian times, there weren't a lot of options for a woman who was childless, who was divorced, who was middle-aged, and she just founded this group and gave herself kind of a second act, a second life.
And Dan, I'm going to jump in on on you there.
Sure.
We're going to take a quick break. More with author Dan Wright in just a moment. Stay with us. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, author Dan White joins us to talk about his brand new book, Under the Stars, How America Fell in Love with Camping. 1-800-892-6477 is how you can join us by phone. You can send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. You can also find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Dan, lots of people who want to jump in on our conversation. Here's an email from Susie. The Blair Witch Project ended my desire to camp. Yikes. Thank you, Susie. Here's another one from Mark, who says, you might want to talk about bicycle touring. I have done some long-distance cycling where we camped in official campsites and in unofficial places like fairgrounds, fields, sides of the road. Pretty much the same as backpacking, with more miles traveled in a day. Mark, that's great. And I know that's popular in New Hampshire and Vermont. Here's one from Meg who says, I agree that one can transform a bad camping experience. In our family, there's somewhat a badge of honor. The first time we took our children canoeing on Lake Umbegog, ooh, pretty place, Meg. It started to rain as soon as we left the dock, and we could begin to hear the thunder before we got to our island campsite. Umbegog, by the way, Dan, is a very beautiful remote place in New Hampshire where you can camp on an island or right by the side of the lake, and you have to get there by boat. Meg says, we told the children it was probably trucks and paddled as fast as we could. Before we could finish setting up our campsite, it was pouring. We made dinner under our tarp and read out loud until the rain stopped. We had a wonderful trip in the end. Now our kids know they can enjoy camping no matter what the weather. Cheers, Meg says. And Meg, thank you. Cheers right back to you. It's kind of what you said at the beginning, Dan, that, you know, it teaches you that, yeah, you can, unless something really terrible happens, you can make it. And that's a good lesson.
It sure is. I love that story. I think that's so funny to hear that. Know that you're really in for it because you're on an island. I mean, tough luck getting out of the one.
Right.
But, I think that it's really true that you can redeem something. I mean, I think it's kind of boring to hear about an absolutely idyllic vacation. Let's say someone goes overseas and does this grand tour of Europe, and it's just wonderful, and they had great food all the time, and they went to museums, and nothing really happens. It kind of gets you kind of blank out listening to it for a while. There's something about the camping trip gone awry where I just never get sick of hearing about it because there's an endless variety of things that could go wrong, whether it's the weather, as you mentioned, or critters giving you a hard time, or other campers acting in unpredictable ways. I mean, camping trips can be so hilarious when you're talking about them. And I really think that something in some way always goes wrong. I mean, again, maybe it's just me, but I think it's also intrinsic to camping.
I think one time we were camping the Grand Canyon and we had some very noisy neighbors. 1, 2 in the morning, and the rangers seemed too busy to impose the quiet hour. So that was less than hilarious. But I hear you on the general theme there, Dan. Let's go back to our listeners, and Linda's in Dover. Hi, Linda. Go ahead. Thanks for waiting. You're on the air.
Thank you. I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can, Linda. Go ahead.
My question is how much experience you've had with animals when you're sleeping on the ground. When I've had a ground sleeping camping, I could hear noises in the woods, and it would always scare me because I didn't know what was coming. Actually, nothing ever came. But I wondered if you had animal experiences.
Well, that's great. So, Linda, you haven't had any, and that's good to hear. But, Dan, you've got plenty in this book, and I'm going to ask you about just one, okay, because we won't have time to go through all of them. The marmots in, I think it's King Ridge or Mountain King or something in California. Go ahead.
Yes, in Mineral King, and I'm really
Mineral
glad you
King.
Asked about
okay.
that. And yes, boy, oh boy, do I have experiences with creatures in the nighttime and in broad daylight, unbelievably. If you go up to Mineral King, it's in the Kings Canyon Sequoia National Park area in California. And first of all, just to get there, there's this insane road called Mineral King Road where you feel like you're taking your life in your own hands, this crazy highway that hasn't changed since the 1870s. You know, you arrive there, finally, at your camping spot. We were at this place called Cold Springs Campground, and everybody's sort of scanning the rocks, looking really scared, thinking, what are they so scared of? And then you see these cute little fuzzy things called marmots. They are they're related to, you know, groundhogs. And they have, you know, cute little muzzles. They look like stuffed animals. But the thing that's crazy about the marmot, the yellow-bellied marmot, it will attack your car unprovoked. It will jump into the chassis of your car and root around in your car, and it will try to get the coolant. It will try to suck the coolant out of your car, of course, disabling your car in the process because it's chewing through all the wires. And there's something in the coolant where they crave it, some salt or something. And the coolant is very poisonous. But for some reason, the marmots of Mineral King, and no one is quite sure why, they will drink the stuff, and it's like Powerade. They won't die. They'll just attack it, and they'll drink it. And it seemed almost like an urban or, you know, wilderness legend to me. But my wife and I went up there, and we noticed that, you know, people usually tarp off their cars, where they get a tarp, and they drive over it, and they kind of wrap the car from below just to protect their car from rampaging marmots. But people hadn't really done that in the camps, and so we thought, okay, we'll just get settled in and we'll do it. And lo and behold, just after we park, a big, fat marmot comes running out of the woods with this crazed expression on its face, and it jumps into our car, like literally leaps up into the car. It was crazy. Does a little standing upward long jump and is rattling around in our car looking for the coolant. And we were horrified. We were knocking against the car. We're shaking it, trying to shake the marmot loose, and it wouldn't get out of there. It's just crazy. I mean, and this happens all the time, by the way.
Yeah, so they run toward the cars, these marmots, because they know that there's antifreeze in there, and they love it. And even though it's poisonous, for some reason, it does not kill them.
And, you know, that's a lot of complex thinking, to look at the car and associate it with, you know, something yummy. You drive up, and they look at this, and they think, wow, I'm going to get that. And it's funny, because you go into the trailheads that are near the Mineral King campground, and all the cars are just so wildly overwrapped. I mean, every single car is just wrapped and wrapped and with different colors of tarps. And different people, I saw people hanging CDs, like people used to listen to CDs before MP3s, but people would have these old scratched up CDs that people would dangle with a length of string from the rear view mirrors or for the side view mirrors, because apparently the marmots are scared by motion. And then you'd see these cars where people would put rocks and bricks between the filling up the tire, the rims over the tires, filling up the spaces, trying to get any crack that the marmot could slither through, because people are just terrified. Because the thing is, you were way up there in Mineral King Road, and if a marmot disables your car, which they sometimes will, you can't count on AAA sending a wrecker up there to tow your car away, because it's that super gnarly long road. And so there are people who can potentially get stuck up there because of rampaging marmots. And I think that's one of the craziest things I've ever seen out there, is an animal behaving in ways that seem completely irrational.
Well, and we could talk forever about the marmots, because it's really funny.
Sure.
And in fact, I read that part out loud to my family last night because I couldn't believe it. The amount of, you know, coolant that a marmot can drink would kill a bear. You talk to a biologist.
It would kill a bear. And these ones will just go out there, and they're not even staggering. They would win a drinking contest of coolant. And it's just a strange evolutionary mystery. And I talked to a marmot expert, and he was puzzling over it. He said that, you know, it's not completely unheard of for marmots to do this kind of thing, to act in weird ways. But he said to pursue your car, to run towards your car and leap into it, that is unique to Mineral King. I mean, there's something going on there.
Let's take another call.
A research paper for somebody.
Yeah. Linda, thank you so much. And Vanessa's in Westminster, Vermont. Hi, Vanessa. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you today?
Good. Go ahead, Vanessa.
Well, my story begins 17 years ago when my daughter and her best friend come over the house. It's Labor Day weekend. You know how families didn't have a whole lot of money to go and do anything, but the kids begged and pleaded if we could go camping. I said, sure, no problem. So then my husband says, well, we don't have a lot of money. He says, but we'll take some out of the fund and we'll go camping. Well, lo and behold, we go to get the check. The check never appeared. So now we have no money. So look at two little girls and tell them they're not going to go camping. That was really sad.
So what'd you do, Vanessa?
I didn't do anything. Those precious children pulled out their $5 and all their change, put it on a table, we counted it up, we had enough money to buy hot dogs, rolls, potato chips, and mustard. So off we went. We set up camp, we're having a great time, we're going to have the cookout tomorrow, goes to bed, a thunderstorm comes. And we had put in our food in the brook inside a cooler because we couldn't even afford ice. So then the brook goes up, we lose everything.
The cooler floated away.
Went away. So the littlest one, as calm as she is, little Ryan, says, Mommy, can't we at least look for it? I says, honey, with that much water, I don't think we can. And then Tammy says, please, please, I don't want to go home now.
Did you find it, Vanessa?
Actually, they found the hot dogs and the mustard. The bread was totally not going to work. But we found sticks, we carved them, we ate bear hot dogs and mustard. And I'll tell you, we had the best time.
Oh, Vanessa, that's great. And we keep getting back to that, Dan, don't we?
We do. You know, and that was a great story and well told. I mean, you had me on the edge of my seat. I thought, this is the most suspenseful thing. And I think that these camping trips, even when they go poorly for part of the time, It's like these little miniature epic. There is something about the epic of what you are saying. And I love the fact that it all worked out at the end. The other thing that's amazing is that the attitude of your kids. They rolled with this. We don't want to go home. I mean, that makes me think that they are lifers for sure, that they're going to always be interested in camping, because there's something about that experience, the adventure, the unpredictability of it, the search for the food, that made it worthwhile for them. So that was wonderful to hear.
Well, here's another epic story from Matt in Manchester. When I was in college at UNH, a group of friends and I planned a 3-day trip through the White Mountains. I ended up feeling ill the morning we left, but was so excited for our trip, I decided to push through it, assuming it was just a bug. 2 days into the trip, I could barely sleep, and my throat was so sore I could barely eat. When we hiked out on day 3, I immediately went to the hospital and was diagnosed with mono. As painful as that trip was, to this day, I'm still glad I did it. Who else can say they hiked 3 4,000 footers with mono? Wow, Matt, I wouldn't recommend it, but what a great story. Here's another one from Ray in Dalton, who says, I grew up in Salem before I-93 went north. He says, I remember a camping trip to Dolly Copp Campground. That's in the White Mountains, for those who don't know. It took over 4 hours on the road as we traveled through every town, Route 3 and then 28. Ray says, I remember seeing a photo of the family of 5. None of us looked happy. Okay, let's get real. There is often some grumpiness. Not all kids are as, adaptive, let's say, as Vanessa. Mine included, Dan. I don't know about yours.
These stories are so great. I mean, there's this real spirit. How many people can say they've hiked all these mountains with mono? I mean, see, that the whole thing is worth it for that punchline.
Well, here's another one from Joy in Brentwood. We just got home from a week tent camping in the Fort Wilderness Campground at Walt Disney World. It was fabulous. Few bugs, no alligators, easy access to the parks, cheaper than a hotel, and we made most of our meals at the site, saving a fortune on food. Joy also says it was also diverse, with multiple families of color, foreign families, Hispanic families, broad swath of humanity. Loved it, Joy says. So she's saying at this campground in Florida anyway, she did find a fair bit of diversity, addressing what we talked about earlier, Dan, why camping largely is so white. I wonder what you think. In certain areas, it might be different.
I think that's really true. I think it's really true. Actually, I noticed that in Mineral King when I wasn't absolutely battling marmots, just, you know, trying to save my car. I thought, gee, this campground is more diverse than what I've seen before. So I really think maybe things are turning around and maybe the picture is changing. It's very encouraging, and I really love to hear that that was what you saw when you were out there. That's great. And I think that there are these different sort of microclimates. I mean, to this day, I'll still have a certain camping experience and I'll think, gosh, this could use more diversity, and others where it's completely different. I think it in some sense, it might depend how close you are to an urban area, perhaps. I mean, that might be one factor.
Let's take another call. This is James in Bristol. Hi, James. Thanks for calling The Exchange. You're on the air.
Hi there. I have a little different view of camping. I have a 37-foot motorhome, and I don't go out without my washer, dryer, and DirecTV dish and all those other things. And there are a lot of us, I'm 75, there are a lot of us that the only way we really can get out is doing it the way I do it. And it's wonderful because I stay in campgrounds that are pretty rural, but still we have our 30-amp hookup and can have all the things that have turned out to be necessary in our lives.
Well, James, I'm so glad you called because I did want to ask you about this, Dan. So thank you so much, James. You tried all kinds of camping as part of writing this book, including renting an RV, something you had never done. You started your camping career as a hardcore backpacker. So what was that evolution like for you?
Well, you know, that was really interesting for me because I never even thought about that. First of all, the caller who just called in, I thought that was a really great story, and I think it's a legitimate form of camping with a rich tradition. But for me, I agreed. I mean, you can go out there and have these wild experiences and have these convivial experiences in an RV park. For me, the thing that was so tough, even after being a hardened backpacker and feeling self-reliant, was just operating the motorhome. I thought that was really scary. We had a 37-footer, but we had a 27-footer, and I felt like it was super hard to just maneuver around and not squish people in cars and stuff. I mean, I was constantly vigilant, looking at the side mirrors and just the bulk of it. And, you know, for me to be that guy, to be that guy going up the steep mountain grade with people honking, pull over, and you know, me saying, I can't find a place to pull over. I mean, that was really eye-opening for me to be that guy.
It was also eye-opening, though, because you loved it.
I did love it, because here's the thing. Once I got more used to the idea of physically operating the thing, then I was really completely in line with the caller. I mean, I was amazed at the feeling of having something where you can just travel around and drive all day. You go up to an RV park, you've got an instant community, which I loved, by the way, in a clubhouse, hear everybody's stories, you do your hookup, you get your utilities all set up, but you still have a feeling of this temporary community. You still have a feeling of ritual, you know, and you still have this tradition. And so in some sense, it seemed strikingly, you know, less far removed than I thought from backpacking. And I also can see how, as I get older, that could be the way that I will go as well. Once I get used to the driving, I mean, I can see why people would be so hooked by that lifestyle. I can understand the appeal.
Well, James, thank you so much for calling. And I want to close out with an email from Jeffrey, who says, if you believe in science and evolution, then you may also believe that we came from the woods. Most people are just about fully disconnected from nature. Camping allows for a reconnection with our primitive selves. We are animals, just like everyone else, because that's where we're supposed to be, instead of living in a fantasy, materialistic world. Jeffrey says, I find it funny that my ancestors knew what to and what not to eat, and yet today people don't even know where their food comes from. Best regards, Jeffrey says. Jeffrey, thank you so much. And Dan, it was great to talk to you. We could have talked a lot longer, but we'll close it out now. Happy camping, and thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me on your program.
That's Dan White again. He's the author of the new book, Under the Stars, How America Fell in Love with Camping. Remember, our conversation always continues online on Facebook and at nhpr.org. This is The Exchange on NHPR.